All right, I call this meeting of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. We are holding remote hearings pursuant to House Rule 10.01. I have been notified that a quorum is present. Anna, will you please take the roll?
Chair Becker Finn, be here in a moment. Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Scott?
Present.
Representative Feist?
Present.
Representative Frazier? Representative Grossel?
Present.
Representative Hur?
Present.
Representative Hollins?
Present.
Representative Johnson? Representative Liebling?
Present.
Representative Long?
Present.
Representative Mortensen?
Present.
Representative Novotny?
Present.
Representative Farr?
Present.
Representative Robbins?
Present.
Representative Vang?
Present.
Representative Zhang?
Present.
Representative Frazier? Representative Johnson?
Present.
All right, thank you. So members, today we have, we'll be hearing four bills and we'll have an informational hearing on another bill. Before we get to the bills, I need approval of the minutes from April 7, 2021. Representative Feist, would you like to move the minutes from April 7, 2021?
Yes, Madam Chair, so moved.
All right, any discussion of the minutes? All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for April 7, 2021 are approved. Our first bill that we'll be discussing today is House File 600, Legalization of Adult Use Cannabis. Majority Leader Winkler, I know this is your bill, and since you're not a member of this committee, I will move the bill for you. I will move that House File 600 be recommended to be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. Representative Winkler, welcome to the committee, and please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of this committee. This is a very important hearing today, and the work that you're doing could not be more timely in this moment. House File 600 is part of a package of bills that needs to be discussed today. The purpose of House File 600 is to eliminate the harm that cannabis has in our society. The primary harm that cannabis poses in Minnesota is the prohibition and criminal enforcement of cannabis. The goal of House File 600 is to shift an illegal marketplace that is policed and over-policed disproportionately, and instead to create a policy of repair and opportunity for those most adversely affected by the war on drugs. In Minnesota, whites and African Americans use cannabis at approximately the same rate, but arrest records are hugely disproportionate. According to the ACLU of Minnesota, anywhere from an African American is 4 to 10 times more likely to be arrested for a cannabis possession charge than a white Minnesotan is. This committee does not need any information from me about the consequences of those arrests, the consequences of those stops, the consequences of felony convictions, not only for the person who has the conviction, who may undergo, of course, prison time, but also have a very long period of probation, may have difficulty finding housing, finding jobs, be disqualified from voting, have a difficulty supporting family members, and have a difficulty being an active and supportive member of our society and in their community. Cannabis does have some harm. It is not conducive to the development of adolescent brains, and it can, in certain cases, exacerbate certain psychological conditions. Cannabis, however, is much safer than legal substances like alcohol and tobacco, which we regulate and tax. The approach of House File 600 is to address the real harms of cannabis and create an opportunity for Minnesota to move past a failed policy that disproportionately impacts people of color, and instead create an opportunity for those communities most adversely affected to participate in a legal regulated marketplace with jobs, with business ownership, and with expungement of criminal records. For this committee's jurisdictional purposes, I'd like to just briefly describe the expungement provisions of this bill. We have expungement in Minnesota. It is a cumbersome process. This bill seeks to make it automatic for those who have less than a felony conviction. If you have a felony conviction on your record, if you are incarcerated, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is directed to identify those individuals and to submit their records to a court for a legal expungement order. If you have a felony conviction or above, we create an expungement board, a cannabis expungement board, tasked with reviewing those records and determining expungement or some reduced sentence. The goal is to eliminate those records that belong, that are attached to people who have engaged in activity that was criminal but is now seen as an illegitimate criminal prohibition by more than two-thirds of the public. The criminal justice system cannot legitimately use the power of arrest, the power of conviction, the power in some cases of taking life for a use of a substance that more than two-thirds of the public believe can be used safely and should be legal. It is not legitimate. That is the goal of this bill. I'm happy to talk at length about the ways in which we create a marketplace in which individuals and communities adversely affected by cannabis can participate. We provide funding and grants to people to participate in the market. We provide direct community grants for those adversely affected by the war on drugs. But the goal and the whole structure of this bill is to end prohibition, and not just end it, but then create real opportunity for those who've been hurt by prohibition. And Madam Chair, I'm used to a different forum. Madam Chair, I think there are a number of testifiers, and they can speak to the provisions of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. And it's my understanding that we have about four testifiers who are here in support, a couple with concerns. So members, my intention is that we'll get through all of those testifiers and then we'll move to member questions. I believe your first testifier is Munira Mohammed.
Madam Chair.
It's Representative Scott.
Thank you. Thank you for recognizing me. Real quickly before we get started with testimony, do you know how much time is allotted to the discussion on House File 600 today? Or is it open-ended?
Thank you, Representative Scott. I would like to try to move to a vote by 1:30 today, but we do have some extra time, according to House Media, to go a little bit longer with this hearing.
Madam Chair?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think that's going to be enough time. I have a multitude of questions. There are more areas of this bill that relate to the what we oversee in this committee than just the expungement pieces. There's a lot of data practices. There's a lot of boards set up here that are going to be dealing with a lot of issues and data. There's penalties. I just don't think, because that's going to be about 20 minutes. And I don't know how long each testifier is going to be testifying, but I would ask for more latitude to for our members to discuss this in more detail than just in 20 minutes, couldn't be done in 20 minutes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Let's just get going here with the testimony. And with your comments that you do have a lot of questions, I'll just remind testifiers that we do have a lot of member discussion. So if you can keep your testimony as tight as possible and to those areas that are most impacted by this committee in the bill, I'll note that this bill has made a number of other committee stops and that many members have already seen this bill in other committees too. But I do think it's important with respect to the provisions that are at issue before the Judiciary Committee that we have time to discuss those. So I will go ahead and move to testifiers, and I believe you have turned your camera on. So go ahead and introduce yourself and you can begin.
Hello, everyone. Chair and House Representatives, my name is Manera Mohammed. I'm the Policy Associate for ACLU Minnesota, and I'm here to speak today in support of House File 600 regarding cannabis legalization. And I'm sure none of you are strangers to this topic, so I will be as brief as possible. Cannabis laws desperately need reform due to the stark racial disparities in marijuana possession arrests and the fact that they haven't gotten better in Minnesota or nationwide. Nationally, on average, a Black person is 3.6 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than a white person, even though Black and white people use marijuana at similar rates. Here in Minnesota, a Black person is 5.4 times to be arrested than a white person, which is specifically significantly higher than the national average. The disproportionate targeting and over-policing of Black communities for a substance that is equally used amongst the population is a natural consequence of marijuana criminalization and the byproduct of the failed war on drugs. It goes without saying that the personal cost to those arrested can ruin lives. Being caught with even the smallest amount of marijuana can risk your housing status, employment opportunities, child custody determinations, immigration status, and your eligibility for financial aid. House File 600 is a viable path towards legalizing marijuana use and possession for Minnesota adults. It has strong provisions that don't simply replace marijuana prohibition with a system of onerous fines and fees, which can drive families into debt and economic instability. It also provides clemency or resentencing for certain marijuana convictions that people have been incarcerated for, and the expungement of past marijuana convictions. We sincerely hope that the legislature takes quick and serious action on moving this forward. If full legalization does not occur, we will see further arrests for possession, ever-increasing prison populations, and the criminalization of Black and brown communities. ACLU Minnesota urges you to support House File 600, and a big thank you to Representative Winkler for bringing this forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mohammed. Our next testifier is Larry McDonough. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. My name is Larry McDonough, and I'm Senior Minnesota Counsel with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. And I've put together a very quick slideshow of my comments on the bill. Here's my information about myself. The Lawyers Committee supports the bill. Criminalization of cannabis has caused denial of housing and evictions, both of which lead to homelessness. And while the House File 600 will help with denial of housing, to help with eviction, and it will need a couple of amendments. So quickly about denial of housing. Criminal records are used quite a bit in applicant screening, and illegal drug activity is a common basis for rental application denial. The links to these studies are active, so when you get this on your website, you can take a look at the studies and details if you wish. Another study looked at around 10,000 households and 15,000 individuals and looked at the links between criminal history and housing outcomes and found that there was no evidence of any link to bad housing outcomes from prior use of marijuana. But the fact that criminal histories are used a lot in tenant screening has led to some regulatory ordinances in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So this bill will help by taking kind of the cannabis use and legitimizing it and taking that out of people's criminal history and making it less likely they'll be denied housing on that front. Tenants can be evicted for illegal drug possession under 504B171, and some cities actually require landlords, force landlords to evict tenants for legal use to keep their rental licenses, whether the landlords want to do that or not. House File 600 doesn't change this. Article 1, Section 8 says that tenants can use cannabis, adult tenants, if explicitly permitted by the owner. This means that use where the lease is silent would be unlawful and would support eviction. So a couple ways to deal with this would be to kind of change the language in subdivision or little section 2 here as written. This one option would allow tenants to use cannabis, adult tenants to use cannabis on the property unless forbidden by the landlord. But just editing it this way would still lead the tenant subject to prosecution if the tenant, if the landlord forbade use and the tenant used it. And so the amendment that we would prefer would to carve out some language specific to landlords and tenants that would say that a tenant can use marijuana on the property, while the owner may prohibit it, that a violation of that would not lead to criminal sanctions, but would allow the landlord to evict if the landlord had that in his or her lease. Another change that would need to be made would be to have a change in 504B171 that is not in this bill right now, and to simply create a reference to Chapter 342 in there, and I've got some proposed language where that would fit in the statute. Thank you very much for hearing me, and if you have any questions, I will stick around.
Thank you, Mr. McDonough. The next testifier is Marcus Harkis. Please introduce yourself, and you can begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Marcus Harkis. I'm from North Minneapolis. I've been a cannabis consumer for 22 years and a legalization advocate for the past seven. I've literally heard from hundreds of Minnesotans who have been victims of these unjust prohibition laws, but almost all of them are too afraid to tell their stories publicly, and most are too afraid to even tell legislators privately. Today, I'll read a brief statement from a man who traveled from Greater Minnesota to share his story with me in Minneapolis. Quote, as an adult, I have used marijuana socially and personally as a means of helping me to relax, meditate, and sleep. The fact that I find marijuana enjoyable and useful for these purposes has never interfered with my ability to perform in my job as an attorney, nor has it inhibited me in my role as a husband or father. My lone experience with the adverse effects of marijuana had nothing to do with marijuana use at all. I had worked hard throughout law school to position myself to be hired as an assistant county attorney. And when I finally had the opportunity, my wife, who was 5 months pregnant, and I made preparations for the move. A week before we were scheduled to close on the home, I was making the long weekly commute to the community where I worked. When I was stopped for having a burnout license plate, and ultimately cited for possessing 2.5 grams of marijuana. I was not under the influence nor using marijuana at the time. It was simply within my vehicle and in my possession. From a legal standpoint, this resulted in a petty misdemeanor citation and a $300 fine. From a personal standpoint, however, this petty misdemeanor citation was a catastrophe. My employer, when advised of the citation, forced me to resign. This required my wife and I to withdraw from the purchase agreement of the home we were buying and of the home we were selling. On top of that, neither of us had jobs, as my wife had resigned from her position in anticipation of the move. This petty misdemeanor citation cost my family thousands upon thousands of dollars in income and pushed us to the financial brink. All of this had nothing to do with the adverse effects of marijuana use, and everything to do with the collateral consequences that come about as a result of marijuana being illegal, unquote. So as this story shows us, the most dangerous thing about cannabis is getting caught with it. Prohibition is the problem, not cannabis, and full legalization is the only solution. Please pass House File 600. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harkis. Chris Wright, you're up next. Go ahead and introduce yourself. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. The only reason I urge you to support HF 600 is because we get more justice from the legalization by fraud than criminalization by fraud. But fraud is fraud. Article 13, Section 7 of the Minnesota Constitution says, any person may sell or peddle the products of the farm or garden occupied and cultivated by him without obtaining a license. Therefore, indeed, Section 8 of this bill is illegal and unconstitutional. While artificial entities may be licensed, natural persons cannot. To jail farmers, Governor Floyd Olson and the legislature of 1935 defrauded Minnesotans of this right by requiring an illegal pharmacy license. This historic injustice usurped and defrauded us of our freedom to cultivate without a license. They destroyed public safety, solicited and monetized crime, caused murder, false imprisonment, systemic racism, trigger happy police, and then they had the nerve to call us criminals. And now you want us to reward this criminal act by giving you police power to defraud us again. And we're just supposed to let you get away with it? Well, cannabis makes you cough, but politics makes you gag. Please, those with integrity, restore our rights, reform our laws, and with any luck, reveal to a doubting world what Minnesota still can be. I invite you to read my proposed amendments for this bill and my extended remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. The next testifier is Michael Dobb. Welcome to the committee. I don't see you yet, but maybe if you start talking, we'll see you. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Michael Daub. I'm a drug and substance use disorder policy advocate. I'm affiliated with SAM Minnesota. In 2021, despite substantial evidence of danger to public health, the effort to legalize cannabis in Minnesota is reaching a new high following the budding cannabis legalization experiments in other states. I believe that in Minnesota, we must end the false dichotomy that there are only two options when it comes to drug policy, legalization or criminalization. To be blunt, the overall goal of drug policy should be to reduce drug use and connect those who are suffering from substance use disorders with recovery resources. Your choices are not between locking up users and fostering a for-profit industry. As we approach the 50-year milestone of President Nixon's war on drugs, it's time to acknowledge that it's been a failure. Instead, it's time to focus on a public policy in Minnesota stating that drug use and substance use disorders are public health issues. I cannot support the broad scope of House File 600 unless a new public policy is established. Legislation should establish it at once. It's time to hasten the end of low-level cannabis possession offenses and expunge those convictions. We've been painfully reminded again this week that over-policing and incarceration of people of color must end. The recent report from the Minnesota House Select Committee on Racial Injustice includes such recommendations. You should adopt these recommendations at once. In conclusion, turning to cannabis use disorder, it's imperative that help become readily available to those afflicted. In the bigger picture, the availability of treatment for substance use disorders should also expand. Cannabis tax revenues should be placed in a special fund and dedicated to treatment, as promised by Representative Winkler. Education campaigns focusing on research and scientific findings illustrating the danger to public health from cannabis should be immediately expanded, regardless of whether or not legalization proceeds. I cannot support the broad scope of House File 600 unless educational programs about the danger to public health begin. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Daub. And I believe our final testifier is Sheriff Kevin Torgerson. Welcome to the committee. Sheriff, please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee for hearing me today on this very important issue. I am Multnomah County Sheriff Kevin Torgerson, representing the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. The Sheriff's Association opposes House File 600 to legalize marijuana. To pass this legislation will not make our community safer and will increase the ability for our youth to access this drug. Currently, our state is in a desperate battle to save lives in an opioid epidemic coupled with serious drug issues at the core of most crime in general across our state, from catalytic converter thefts to murders. Drug use, trafficking, addiction, and deaths are increasing. Now is not the time to take this step. In my review of this bill, and since our association last testified before you on this topic, nothing in this bill has been done to solve the issues most concerning to law enforcement and has created a new concern. The first being youth access. We can all agree our greatest resource in our state is our next generations. To pass this bill will severely impact our youth by making access to this drug more readily available at a time when potency is at its highest in history. Science has also allowed for potency to develop over the years and has created more pathways to deliver this drug to our kids, marketed as candy and as vaping as a safer way to deliver the drug. To think our kids are not going to be impacted by those marketing implications is a terrible mistake. The second issue law enforcement has raised before and not yet accomplished is the safety on our roads where law enforcement does not have a tool to provide a roadside test. We have had scientific testing for decades related to alcohol in an individual's system at the time of contact. There is yet no way for law enforcement to test and confidently know when a driver is under the influence of marijuana at the time of contact other than by observation. Testing currently can only determine if the drug is in the system of an individual, but cannot determine the level in one system. We should all agree to ensure better testing before we move forward with enforcement. Lastly, the expungement clause could severely impact our ability to prohibit persons from carrying and purchasing guns when doing background checks. We all should agree we want to keep guns out of the wrong hands. So on behalf of the 87 elected sheriffs in Minnesota, please do not pass this bill forward today and do not legalize marijuana in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff. And thank you to all the testifiers. I don't have anybody else on our list, and I just want to say you all kept your comments succinct and to remind members that there are a number of written comments also in your packets. I believe Chair Becker Finn is back, and so I am going to turn the gavel back over to her for member questions.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mueller, for ably handling the beginning of committee. We will get to member questions. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quickly, and this may swerve over into public safety, but when was it just 2 years ago that we did some reform on lowering the penalty on the possession of marijuana? I don't know if the bill's author knows the answer to that question or somebody else on the committee, but was that just 2 years ago?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I'm not quite sure what you're referring to, I guess. We made up to 1.5 ounces of possession, a petty misdemeanor, I think in 1973, but I'm not sure about what we did 2 years ago on that topic, if anything.
Representative Scott.
Okay, Madam Chair. I thought in the last several years, I thought that we would had done something either on the possession and anyway, I just had some questions to follow up, but if we don't know the answer to that, then I won't ask the question. I'm going to start out my questioning, Representative Winkler, regarding the statewide monitoring system. And, you know, businesses submit this monitoring data to this through this monitoring system. And I'm just wondering, does the system keep track of patient or customers of the cannabis? Will that monitoring system keep track of that information?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I have a feeling that your specific questions on these issues are going to be best addressed to Mr. Johnson from House Research. I'm not an expert on those portions of the bill.
Okay.
All right, Mr. Johnson, if you could help us out.
Madam Chair, Ben Johnson with House Research. Madam Chair, Representative Scott and members, the provisions in the bill do not require the collection of information about people who are purchasing marijuana. It just simply requires that the sale be recorded as sort of an endpoint in the distribution from seed to sale.
Follow-up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to toggle back and forth between the bill and my notes here. I'm just wondering because I'm just wondering if there's going to be, in my opinion, there should be some audit trails created and some role-based access to that information. I want to get on to a different section. It's a long bill, just bear with me. if we go to page 34, that's where the powers and the duties of the board begin. And there's some data privacy provisions there, Representative Winkler. And it states that there's most all of that data is going to be classified as private. It's going to be data submitted for the cannabis license, except for the name and designated address. And one of the next bullet points is the identity of a complainant who has made a report concerning a license holder. It says explicitly there that even when the investigation is inactive, and I'm just wondering why that information is so special. Normally, inactive investigative data is public data, but in this case, you're keeping it private, and I was just wondering why.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I am open to talking that through if you think a change would be useful there. That really, I think we're talking about business entities, and the investigations aren't criminal in nature. They are to determine whether licensing standards are being met. So I think the concept of keeping it private could have the benefit of not adversely affecting the business reputation of licensees who may have no wrongdoing whatsoever. And so, you know, if there's a better way to do it, if there's a better way to make sure that we're not creating an incentive for people to trash certain businesses and get some kind of public record of that, I'm open to figuring that out with you.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then the other investigative data here that is generally public following the investigation has to do with violations of statutes and rules. And again, you know, maybe in the first instance, since it was just an allegation that was perhaps, you know, no disciplinary action happened. But in this case, there was clearly a violation. And so I'm wondering if that's something that you might also be open to changing. And I feel like if they're found in violation, then that information should be made public.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, the goal in putting these sections together was to treat cannabis as a business similar to alcohol or tobacco and to essentially apply the same standards. I think, again, Mr. Johnson might be able to provide some context for how we deal with the same questions in those industries. But the goal was the policy goal is to essentially treat it like other types of legal regulated business entities, and to have the Cannabis Management Board to have that same level of oversight, but also to treat the records the same. And Mr. Johnson may be able to provide a little context for that.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, again, Ben Johnson from House Research. Madam Chair, members, the goal of this data was to mirror what's been done with similar data in other states and also be consistent with the way we talk about and classify, obviously, the individual decisions about what data is public or not public.
Mr. Johnson, we're having trouble with your connection. If you could try turning off your video and try again.
My apologies. Looks like you can hear me now. Again, it's Ben Johnson with House Research. The goal of these sections was to mirror much of what is done in other states for similarly collected data, while also being consistent with the way data collected in similar situations under Minnesota law is done. Obviously, the individual decisions related to the specific data and how it should be treated is a policy decision that's up to the members. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Scott, any follow-up? Otherwise, I want to make sure we have time for Representative Johnson and Representative Robbins.
Yes, Madam Chair, I do have some other questions. I want to move on to the medical cannabis and that whole board and the requirements surrounding that. Representative Winkler, did you take kind of the existing medical cannabis law and put it into this bill and just kind of expand it? Or, you know, I didn't have time to compare what's in current law compared to what's in this bill. So if you could just help me out there, that'd be helpful.
Mr. Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, what this language is attempting to model is essentially the reforms that are moving separately in a bill carried by Representative Edelson of the medical program. So we want to, the overall way that we're doing this is we're shifting responsibility for the medical program to the Cannabis Management Board. We are making sure that medical cannabis is not taxed. We are expanding the ability to use flower through the medical program. And we are really just trying to make the medical program work. What we heard overwhelmingly from Minnesotans is that it's too restrictive, it's too expensive, it's too hard to get access. And that while we're creating a legal regulated marketplace for cannabis, we still need a medical program because there are a lot of people who want to do it in conjunction with a prescription or a referral from their doctor and want and feel more comfortable under that kind of situation. And we want to have it be non-taxed. So the provisions in the bill related to medical cannabis are shifting the existing program, expanding it, and changing some of the guidelines. But Representative Edelson's bill on medical cannabis is really the leading kind of edge on what we're doing, and we're following in her wake.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Last question, Representative Scott.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And so I had some concerns with that area. I see that you require a Tennyson warning, and that's very appropriate. And I thank you for putting that in the bill, or maybe that was Representative Edelson's doing, if it's kind of her language. But one of the things that I don't see in here is an opt-out for people. I noticed that a lot of this data is going to be used for research, and there's no opt-out provision here for anyone that's in that program. And certainly I think there should be an opt-out provision. If you don't want your data to be used, your medical record to be used, whether it's aggregated or not, you should have the option of opting out of research. And I had some questions about the liability there too. And my understanding is if a doctor prescribes something that is either not appropriate for you, or it turns out that you have a reaction to what that doctor prescribed and they should have known that it wasn't the right dosage or the right drug for you, you should be held liable. And I'm not seeing in this bill, and correct me if I'm wrong, I could be, it just seems like nobody's held liable here for any of the dispensing of the medical marijuana.
Madam Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott. So that's existing tort law. So if a physician acts or directs a patient to take action that is contrary to the standard of care and it results in harm to that individual, they have a malpractice claim against the physician. So all the existing common law tort and other statutory provisions related to tort law in Minnesota would apply in the medical cannabis program as well.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. I have more questions, but I'll let my other members ask as well. Thank you.
All right. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I'm having trouble with my video, so I keep trying to make it work. I have so many questions as well. I would say the first question I wanted to ask, and I was just looking on the bill for the actual line number, but it's in section 5, I believe. And basically it has to do with the relationship with the courts. And sorry, I'm looking for my page here. So basically it seems like this board can oversee or tell the courts what they can do. And I just wondered, Representative Winkler, if you could address that. It says that the board determines if someone is eligible for resentencing or a lesser sentence, and the court must proceed as if it's been directed by an appellate court. So I'm just worried about the separation of powers here. How can this board have that authority, and does the court have to abide by it?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, yes, the point is to make it automatic so that you don't require a person to apply or to make some kind of showing, hire a lawyer, take active steps themselves, but rather to determine what the criteria, whether the criteria in the statute have been met, and then have the order issued directly by the court. So an expungement is a court order, and this is an automatic order that will be issued based on the findings of this board. In the case of lower level cannabis convictions, the board doesn't even have to review it. It's simply a matter of the BCA providing a list of individuals to the court for those orders to be issued.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Winkler. So have you spoken to the courts about this, and are they supportive of this?
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, I don't recall actually meeting specifically with the judicial branch about this, but I don't have any separation of powers concerns regarding this bill. The judiciary is still subject to state statute, just like every other branch of government.
Representative Robbins, and then we're gonna move on to Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have, I have a lot more questions, but I'll leave it to one more. In section, I can't remember the section, but it's line number 22.19 and following the bill, it talks about violations and penalties. And basically it gives the board the ability to assess civil penalties for all the different levels that could be perceived as a violation. And I just found this very unusual that a appointed board would be able to assess civil penalties on individuals. And when I read the language, it doesn't seem to say, you know, does the majority of the board decide? Does it have to be a unanimous decision? So could you talk more about why you're giving this ability to assess penalties, civil penalties, to the board? Is that done anywhere else in statute? And then what sort of level of unanimity is required or majority to make the penalties be assessed? Thank you.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Robbins, it's a regulatory board. So it has all the administrative law authority to issue rules, make findings, and issue penalties, which of course are appealable then to a court. It certainly does not have criminal jurisdiction over individuals.
Right. I see that. Do any other regulatory boards? Oh, sorry.
Representative Robbins. And then we really do need to move on to Representative Johnson and the vote.
I'm sorry. I'll defer to Representative Johnson. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yep. Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfin, members. Give me a second here. I have the distinction of being in two committees at once here, so I'm trying to keep them straight. I'm looking at this bill and I do have problems with it. I'm sure everybody knows that. But I'm wondering, there are civil penalties if somebody is over their number of plants in excess. Looks like a person can grow 8 plants with 4 mature plants at one time. But then I look at the grid for penalties. If a person has 4 plants, that's equal to approximately, if they're well-nourished and well-maintained, that's about 4 pounds of marijuana. And I look down through the grid, if he's transporting it from where he's growing it, then he gets caught. There's civil penalties for the of $25,000. The person is within the guidelines with his 4 plants. He has, but he's over the amount that he can legally carry by 4 pounds. I'm just wondering how, if, even though it's a civil penalty, and is it my understanding that Representative Winkler, that the board is going to be assessing these penalties?
Representative Winkler.
So So, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I just want to clarify one thing. The permission to have, or the authority to have home grow and to have, I think, up to 10 pounds at home is different from the right to transport it. The idea is that if you have it at home and you use it at home for your own personal use, that is one set of activities. It is very different if you start carrying large amounts around other places, because then it begins to look like you are engaged in distribution in an illegal market. If you wish to purchase, and bring it home, you are subject to restrictions on how much you can carry, where you can consume it, where you can possess it in certain cases. You can't sell it to minors. There are all sorts of restrictions built around the continued use, transport, and sale of cannabis if you are not within the regulated marketplace. And the exception is the home grow, but that is intended to be raised and cultivated and used in your home, not transported.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
I will leave it at that. I do have just one more thing. A friend of mine that I've met at my church wanted to testify today. Unfortunately, he does not have a phone or access to a computer right now to call in to testify. Had a great conversation with him. The gentleman's name is Ted. He's still planning one of these stops to testify, but I wanted to relay some of the information that he passed on to me. In talking with him, he is against this bill. He's in drug rehab right now. He's doing very well in the program. And when he heard about this proposal, he was very upset. He started with marijuana and got that first high. And it made him work to get more and more in different highs. It devastated his life. It wasn't because of charges dealing with marijuana. It's because marijuana got him into other things. He lost his child. He was taken away because of his drug use and the other crimes he committed because of the drug addiction. So he has a lot of concerns with this because he understands what marijuana actually does. We're hoping to get to one of these next stops, get Ted to be able to actually testify so he can tell his own story. With that, I'm gonna request members of my committee not to vote for this. I appreciate what the sheriff said as well. It's gonna be detrimental to the safety on the roads. The Colorado study has already proven that with marijuana-related death fatal accidents up dramatically in Colorado. But with that, I will leave it there. We can move on. Like I say, right now, this is not a good idea to pursue this. You have states that have had a number of issues. And with that, I will turn it back over to the chair.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. And was going to move us to the vote, but I do see Representative Novotny that you have your hand up. Out of respect to you, I will go to you for a question, but we'll just remind members that we have four additional bills that we will be hearing today, and I will not be rushing through that. I think those are incredibly important bills, and so if we could just keep that in mind as we figure out what to ask on the record and what might be able to be asked later on in conversation with Representative Winkler or others. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief. The question is for the author. You've got specific immunity built in for the board and the governor and employees of the state agencies. What situations would you see where the governor would be civilly liable, and why is that important in the current environment?
Representative Winkler.
Representative Novotny, it sounds like we're getting close to a qualified immunity kind of question. And qualified immunity for public officials is intended to protect them from individual liability when they make errors in their job or make mistakes. And there's a lot we could have conversations about with respect to what the doctrine is, how it's evolved over time, how it's used or misused, and who it applies to. And I think that is a subject for another bill today. In general, qualified immunity protects from civil liability the errors in judgment of public officials. It's a longstanding protection, and it probably needs some significant reform, but that is not the purpose of this bill.
All right. Yep, quick follow-up, Representative.
I would just like to point out this is part of this bill, page 81. No, it's not about the next bills. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Closing comments, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So first of all, I just want to clear up some misinformation. In fact, the bill does have prohibitions on marketing to children. It is impermissible to sell or market products that are appealing to children. So there was no candy, there's no colorful characters or anything of that nature permitted under the bill. It's a lesson learned from Colorado, which made early mistakes in that. We are in fact providing more training for drug recognition experts in law enforcement in this bill. We are providing additional funding and continue to do more for substance use disorder counseling and treatment. We are actually doing the things that the critics of the bill would like us to do in this bill already, and we are very open to doing more. This is a responsible approach to cannabis. This is an approach to cannabis that will actually prevent more people from getting misinformation, from getting access to cannabis as youth, and will actually allow us to have a rational policy that protects public health. Prohibition has not succeeded in doing that. It is time to end prohibition of cannabis, create a safe, legal, regulated marketplace, correct past wrongs of the war on drugs, and move forward as a state. Cannabis legalization is coming, and it is time for Minnesota to get it right. That's what this bill represents, and I ask for your support today.
All right. Thank you, Representative Winkler. Vice Moeller renews her motion that House File 600 be recommended to be re-referred to State Government Finance. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Nope.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Hurt.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
No.
Representative Novotny.
No.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Fang. Representative Fang. Representative Zhang.
Aye.
There are 9 ayes and 7 nays.
All right, with 9 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 600 is recommended to be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. Thank you, Representative Winkler, and to the testifiers. We will move right along to our next bill. We'll just remind members that we received a lot of written testimony from the public on these next 3 bills. If you have not had the time to look over that testimony, I encourage you to. I think especially in these times when it's we're not meeting in the state office building and people cannot show their views in that way by showing up to our meetings in person, I think it's incredibly important that we take a look at that testimony that's submitted that way. The next bill we'll be hearing is House File 640. This is a Chair Gomez bill. Welcome to the committee, Chair Gomez. Since you are not a member of this committee, I will move your bill. I will move that House File 640 be recommended to be placed on the general register. And then now that the bill is before us, I think we have a DE1 amendment. Chair Gomez, if you could just confirm that that is your amendment and I can get that moved.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that's my amendment. Do you want me to explain it, or are you going to move it?
Sorry. I will move it, and then you can explain it. Cool. So I will move the DE1 amendment to House File 640. Chair Gomez, please explain the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So the DE, this House File 640 was heard in public safety It's in the public safety omnibus bill, but we changed it in the meantime from being prescriptive to permissive. And so this changes the language to align with the language that's in the public safety omnibus bill. Also on lines 2.22 to 2.24, it clarifies the way that data produced in the course of an investigation conducted by one of these oversight boards will be treated. So that might be of particular interest to members of the committee.
All right, thank you, Chair Gomez. With that, we'll do this on a voice vote. All those in favor of the DE1 amendment to get it in the shape the author desires, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the DE1 amendment is adopted. Your bill is now before us in the shape that you would like it. Please tell us about your bill, Chair Gomez.
Thank you very much, Chair Becker-Finn and members of the committee. Good to see everyone this afternoon. So we had scheduled this hearing, I think last week we decided to do this. The chair planned to hear this bill and the two bills that Representative Thompson's going to present next because we're in this moment right now as a community and as a state and a country, really. As we all know, the Derek Chauvin trial is proceeding and George Floyd's family and his loved ones and all of us, and especially, you know, Black people across the community and the world are subjected again and again to the horror of videos and diagrams and extensive explanation of what we all saw plainly with our eyes. A public execution by a public employee of a Black man, a beloved Black father, a Black son, a brother and a community member in the street. And the chair wanted to bring us together to discuss these bills. You know, they're three small parts of a larger effort that we're all engaged in together to try to align our laws to help build true community safety for all the people of our state. An effort to show that we're listening, that we're trying, that we know that the status quo right now is not working for large parts of our communities. So, you know, the chair wanted to take action and to hear from impacted community members in the midst of the trauma of this trial that's bringing up so much stuff for a lot of people. And now this, now here we are. Now Dante Wright was killed by police officers, another public execution by a public employee of a beloved Black man, father, son, community member in the street. Dante Wright should be here today. He should be with his partner, China, and their young son. I just think we all agree that nobody should die in the street during a traffic stop. Dante Wright's parents were on Good Morning America yesterday, the day before, Katie and Aubrey. And of course it was like, you know, as a parent, you know, it's just devastating to see their pain. They had just bought their son a car, and during the stop, Dante called his mom because he wasn't sure they were going to ask him for the insurance information. And so he called her because he didn't know it. And she said, "I know my son was scared. He's afraid of the police. And I'd just seen and heard the fear in his voice." You know, our children, especially our Black boys, go through their lives and see with their own eyes and in their own experiences that they're not safe in this world, that they're not safe interacting with the police. Every Black man has a story about the indignity experienced in interactions with police, almost without exception. And when our sons see that the police can kill 12-year-old Tamir Rice and never be held accountable, how are they supposed to not feel fear when they're in these interactions? So this bill is about accountability. And honestly, it's like a way downstream effort. It's minimal, in my opinion. Alone, it's not going to change the fundamental power dynamics that lend themselves to the abuses that we see happening in our communities. But basic accountability is a basic necessity. This summer, my district is where George Floyd was murdered by Minneapolis police officers, and it was the epicenter of a global uprising of people demanding justice and fairness in their interactions with law enforcement. this is one of the components that didn't make it over the line when we did our police accountability work together last summer. But it's really important, I think, to making real progress so that the relationships between police and the communities that they serve can be improved. This bill, House File 640, would allow governing bodies to empower civilian review authorities to conduct independent investigations with full subpoena power, to issue findings of fact based on those investigations, and to impose discipline on officers who are found to have committed misconduct. Under current state law, as of 2012, civilian review bodies are explicitly barred from issuing findings of fact related to allegations of officer misconduct or imposing discipline. As I mentioned, on lines 2.22, that's the kind of the treatment of data associated with investigations conducted by civilian review bodies. What in my city, this is the only context I have for this, what our community sees when they look at the current oversight apparatus is a body that sustains complaints at a very low rate, about 2.5% over the last 10 years, and imposes discipline even less frequently. And so this happens even while our residents, our tax dollars, pay out in some cases up to tens of millions of dollars in settlements related to police misconduct. They see that over the last decade, it's taken MPD an average of a year and a half to process misconduct complaints, and that citizens and journalists have trouble accessing data associated with these investigations that's supposed to be public. In sum, we rely heavily on police departments to regulate themselves based on information that's generated not by an investigation, by an impartial outside body, but by the department itself. So we've tried this. We've tried to allow police to regulate themselves. We've done it for decades. It does not work. It's not seen as legitimate by the community. Self-regulation, when the stakes here are so high, when they're literally life and death, is just not a viable option. The officers who repeatedly engage in misconduct or human rights abuses are few, but their impact's incredibly significant. As you may have heard, Officer Chauvin had 18 complaints of misconduct over his career, and he was notorious in the community that I represent. Former Sergeant Bob Kroll had more than 50 complaints over his career and almost a dozen lawsuits where settlements were paid out. And this compromises the legitimacy of policing in my city. Kobe Heisler was killed by Brooklyn Center Police in 2019. I think we're going to hear from his family a little later in this hearing. But when I heard that Officer Potter, who shot and killed Dante Wright, was one of the original responding officers on the day Kobe was killed, I gotta say, it kind of took my breath away just to see the patterns of behavior, emerge. And so if residents don't feel safe interacting with law enforcement because there is not a history of those who engage in misconduct being held accountable, the community won't cooperate with investigations. They won't call 911 when they're the victim of a crime. They'll be terrified and fear for their lives when they interact with the police, just like Katie Wright heard in her son's voice when she spoke to him on the phone. If you honestly believe in the institution of policing, I believe you should welcome efforts to increase accountability for misconduct for those who betray the trust that we place in them. There's no way that law enforcement can do the job that they're hired to do to keep the communities that they serve safe if we don't have basic and transparent systems of accountability in place. And just finally, Madam Chair, I just want to say that, because we had a bunch of hearings on this bill last year. I've had a hearing on the bill this year. And civilian review is not a punishment. We really need to reorient ourselves to this effort. It's not punitive. It's an acknowledgement of reality that there's a broken relationship between large portions of our community and police. We will not be able to move forward in the absence of any accountability. And a relationship without transparency and accountability, whether it's personal or like societal, is abusive and coercive, and it can't hold. The center can't hold, and that's what we're seeing. The center is not holding anymore. Members, if you support the institution of policing, if you want the institution of policing to be legitimate and to have the ability
to fulfill its stated goals, I believe you should support this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. We do have quite a few testifiers. I want to move to them next. First on the list, I have Michelle Gross. Michelle, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Chair Beckerfin, Representative Gomez, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Michelle Gross, and I am the president of the organization Communities United Against Police Brutality. We recently celebrated our 20th anniversary, so we have a good bit of understanding of the history of civilian review within the state of Minnesota. Law enforcement often states that among their goals is the goal of improving their relationship and trust between civilians and law enforcement. That goal is best served when agencies are willing to meet community standards on how they wish to be policed. The language in HF 640 states that communities may create civilian oversight councils and may grant them certain powers. During previous testimony, representatives of various law enforcement organizations claimed that there were no problems in the relationships with their communities. And if that's true, it's likely that members of those communities would see no need to create a civilian oversight body. However, in a number of communities in which policing has been problematic, community members are eager to set expectations for the policing to which they will be subjected. HF 640 allows them to do just that while still preserving the rights of law enforcement officers to the grievance procedures outlined in their collective bargaining agreements. We have worked with a nationally recognized organization called Flex Your Rights on a project called the Open Police Complaints System. In that system, we assessed the ability for people to file complaints and have them heard reasonably with all 417 law enforcement agencies in our state. That system and our research grades the responses of law enforcement agencies to complaints that they receive, the ease of ability to file those complaints, the way that they're adjudicated, any requirements to meet with the chief before you can file a complaint, et cetera. Every single law enforcement agency in this state had great deficits in the way that they allowed complaints to be filed and the way that they adjudicated those complaints. Because agencies were given a grade level, almost all of our agencies in the state achieved a D or an F grade, a failing grade in the way that they handle complaints. The best agencies achieved a C+. So we have serious problems with the way that law enforcement agencies are policing themselves, and it's simply not working. As you are aware, in 2012, civilian oversight bodies were stripped of their ability to operate effectively as a check and balance against police misconduct. Have these bodies been given adequate power to truly serve an oversight function, it is unlikely that former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who had 26 complaints, if you include the internal affairs complaints, and 4 prior deadly force incidents, would have remained employed with the Minneapolis Police Department long enough to have had his 5th deadly force encounter with George Floyd. We have extensively studied the problem of civilian oversight. Just looking at Minneapolis alone, the agency that exists is not independent. It is controlled at all levels by city staff and the Minneapolis Police Department. And as a result, in 8 years of their existence, they have taken in 3,434 complaints, only 20 of which have actually been disciplined. That's a discipline rate of 0.58, less than just over half of 1%, when the national average for civilian oversight bodies is 7 to 8% for discipline. That still means that 92 to 93% of complaints received by civilian oversight bodies historically and across the country are not disciplined. So civilian review is not meant to be a club over police's heads. It's meant to address the serious problem officers. It is also meant to provide a mechanism for input into police policies. It's a cost-saving measure and a risk management measure because it addresses not just problem officers, but problem policies, and allows cities an opportunity to address those conducts before they result in lawsuits. So these are, you know, beneficial not just to the community, but beneficial to the departments and the municipalities themselves. I would ask all of the members of this committee to please pass House File 640. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Next on the list is Glenn Brown. Mr. Brown, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Yes. Okay. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. Thank you so much for providing the platform for me to have my voice. My name is Glenn Brown. I'm a proud member of BBCC, which is Black Barbershop and Black Congregation Cooperative. I'm a resident of Brooklyn Park, Minnesota. I'm a father of three young, beautiful black males, and I have one daughter as well. I'm a husband, and I'm a business owner. I'm here before you today just because I feel it's very absurd, you know, for the thought of moving forward here in Minnesota without passing the bill. A bill that brings transparency and accountability back to every police, you know, department in our state. I think that there's been a string of some most horrific acts, you know, of police brutality, you know, here in our state. And I never witnessed, you know, something this bad, you know. I feel that it's times are getting bad for the worse, you know. I mean, I think about the fact that when you get pulled over by the police officer, that people are really fearing for their life. They feel like their lives are in jeopardy, you know, just for a traffic stop. And I think that we need a thriving, you know, civilian oversight board, you know, as a something to help contribute to change in our community. I think that the police department needs to be more transparent and accountable to the very people that they serve and protect. They took an oath on to serve and protect. I think the state needs to have clear language that mandates this, that makes it a mandatory bill or law or policy. As a community member, a black man, a survivor of police brutality, I felt very powerless, you know, more than I ever care to remember or imagine. But I want to share this moment with you because it's something that reoccur every time I see an act like these that just happened. I think about the time that me being a business owner, I've called the police in my own place of business. And when the officer come, when he first arrived to the situation, it's not even to try to solve the problem. The first thing that comes to mind is to make an arrest. You know, I deal in the field of mental health. So if you are familiar with that, it just comes down to people having disabilities and not being able to really, you know, think for themselves. And sometimes their behavior just take advantage. They take they don't have the capacity to really, like you or I, to really be normal and normalize things. So when the police came, the first thing that they thought about is, you know, to belittle the staff, not to help. And it's the same thing as in the streets. You know, when they come, the first thing, instead of to serve and protect, is violence first. And we need to change that. We need to have civilians, you know, civilians to oversee the activity and encounters of the police in our community. Maybe just by that, you know, by that being a way of bringing the community more together and bridging the gap between officers and civilians. I think that having police to relate with themselves is not working, you know, because things are steady happening. It's a big bridge there between the civilian and the police officer. So I think it has to change. And I hope that through my experience and through my time, you know, sharing, you know, I hope that we can, as the chair and the civilian, I hope that we can come together and really pass this bill, because I think it would be something that would really help change and shape a better future. Thank you very much. I appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you so much for testifying today. On the list, I have, and I'm hoping I'm going to get your name right, Samiat Ajibola. If you could pronounce your name correctly for the record and go ahead with your testimony, please.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Samiat Ajibola, and I use pronouns like she and her. I'm currently a third-year student at the University of Minnesota, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Student Association as next year's student body vice president. I also currently serve as the president of the Black Student Union. I want to first just start off today by thanking everyone for providing me the space to speak today, and I also want to thank the author of this bill, Representative Gomez, for taking the necessary steps to ensure police accountability. I was taught at a young age that I would be seen as a threat to the police because of my skin color. For this reason, I was told to adjust my mannerisms to ensure my safety. So I needed to do things like make sure I was being respectful and using phrases like yes, sir, and no, ma'am, and always having my hands visible. I was told that if I did all these things that I would have no reason to be afraid. However, as I continued to mature, I realized that there was really nothing I could do to ensure my safety in a police encounter. I learned this by having my uncle shot and killed by the police. And it continues to be reaffirmed by seeing young men like Dante Wright, who is basically the same age as me, be murdered by those entrusted in keeping us safe. This bill aims to establish community oversight for police departments and to ensure safety of our population. However, Section 3, Subdivision 2 excludes university campus police departments by limiting oversight to police forces with less than 50 employed officers. I want to ask the question of how are students supposed to feel safe when the officers in their vicinity have no oversight? Across the state, municipal police departments are accountable to be elected by elected mayors or city councils. Since the governing body is elected by the general public, there's an avenue as to which people are holding them accountable. However, according to Statute 137.12, the University of Minnesota's Police Department only answers to the Board of Regents and school administrators. This means that university police has no governance from an elected official and gives them the full ability to avoid oversight from the legislature. As a result, it makes it near impossible for students and the government to hold them accountable, and thus leads to a consistent fear of our police force. UMPD has the same legal status as all other police departments, so I believe that it should be met with the same governance. For this reason, I urgently ask that university police departments, which have less than 50 employed officers, are added to HF 640. By adding this bill, you are giving me and other students the opportunity to no longer live in fear. You're also giving us a chance to know our legislators will stand with us and hold those who abuse the justice system accountable for their actions. I look forward to working with the author and committee in the coming year to ensure this bill protects all communities in need of police oversight. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ajibola, and thank you for your leadership at the U. I think it is really important that our young people and our students be involved in this discussion. So thank you for testifying today. Next on the list, I have Lyndon Gaboy. If you could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Lyndon Gaboy. I'm a member of the Coalition for Justice for Jamar Clark. And we, along with the Minnesota Coalition for Justice for George Floyd and All Stolen Lives, are calling on you to support House File 640 as amended today. My brief testimony, three quick points. The first is that our cities, our towns, and our people should not be hamstrung by the state when we want to find fair and open ways to set community standards for our local police. Stepping out kind of statewide, we acknowledge that not every town has a department-wide problem with their police force, but many towns and cities have had problems with predator officers. The predators, or at least the ones we hear about anyway, are quietly, maybe not so quietly, fired. but those predator officers shouldn't have felt empowered to exploit the vulnerable and marginalized in our towns in the first place. We feel that a civilian oversight body, if the people of a city or town decide to implement one, would be a deterrent to allowing a rotten culture to fester in the force. In closing, I just want to say that many here on this committee want Minnesota to do something about systemic racism. But talk, and I call it happy talk, about diversity and inclusion won't get us there. It is essential that we have our simple and concrete power to go about our daily lives without getting harassed or without worrying about being shot or killed by police. We need to make it clear to the officers that racist acts are not okay. Civilian oversight is one concrete step towards that aim. We have to, as has been said many times before, we have to take steps now to stop future Derek Chauvins and stop predator officers from feeling empowered, not just in the metro area, but statewide. So I urge you to pass House File 640 out of committee today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we will move on to Theodore Rose. Theodore, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Theodore Rose, and I'm a policy director at the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage. Thanks for the opportunity to testify in support of the police accountability proposals that are in front of your committee today. The civilian oversight councils are an important tool for facilitating community participation in the processes of reviewing and improving our law enforcement. These councils can help the state to build mutual trust relations between peace officers and the communities they serve. So we urge this committee to support the Civilian Oversight Council bill. We also want legislators to provide the necessary funding and policy support that will ensure that oversight bodies are inclusive and reflective of the diverse communities they serve. We believe that that is a very important component of community empowerment on these issues and very important matters. So thanks for the opportunity to speak on this bill, and thank you to Chair Gomez for authoring the bill, and that will close my testimony.
Thank you very much for your testimony and for your work with the council. Last, I have Jess Sundin. If you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jess Sundin, and I live in South Minneapolis, where my daughter is a student at South High. I'm a proud union member of AFSCME, and I also work with the Twin Cities Coalition for Justice for Jamar, which is part of the Minnesota Coalition for Justice for George Floyd and All Stolen Lives. I want to urge you to vote in favor of House File 640 as amended today. And the reason I'm asking that is because we should have a democratic right to determine who polices our communities and how our communities are policed. We pay for their salaries and benefits. We pay for their armaments. And we pay for the settlements against them when they kill and harm our neighbors. With the single exception of county sheriffs, they are unelected and yet hold the power of life and death, the power to imprison us or keep us free. And House File 640 clears the way for us to hold some power over them. Communities already know who the most dangerous cops are. Civilians had brought dozens of complaints against Derek Chauvin before he crushed the life out of George Floyd. And he made Minnesota famous again for brutal police murder. These complaints were set aside because there's no civilian authority with the power and willingness to act independent of law enforcement. House File 640 would make it possible for civilians to get dangerous cops off the streets before they kill. Meanwhile, law enforcement would have you believe that they are the only ones qualified to judge whether their actions are appropriate, but this isn't true. As we speak here today, it's a jury of civilians that are sitting in Minneapolis to judge the deadly actions of Derek Chauvin. And in fact, several law enforcement witnesses in this trial have testified that Chauvin's actions were wrong on May 25th, 2020, but none of them acknowledge that his behaviors that day were not new. In fact, law enforcement had protected Chauvin from discipline until now, and it's up to that civilian jury to make right what law enforcement has failed for years to address. House File 640 as amended is just one piece of what we need to allow community members to protect ourselves against the next Derek Chauvin. I urge you all to support it today, and thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and thank you to all the other testifiers. I don't have anyone else on the list, but again, I will direct members. There were quite a few written testimony, quite a few documents for members to review. With that, we will move to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before I ask the question that I have or make the statement that I have or why the bill's in our committee, I just wanted to ask the chair to and others and even the bill's author to remember that we are the legislature. We are not the judiciary. We are not the judge and jury of the cases that are in the news right now. And to use words like murder and execute, I think we can do better. I think that we need to stay away from using words like that and let the judge and the jury decide what's murder and if someone was executed or not. I feel like it's not responsible on our part to use those kind of words. And so, Madam Chair, my question to you is why this bill is in our possession today.
Because this bill is in our jurisdiction and addresses data, and we are going to move this bill forward. I also thought it was really important that we do talk about these bills publicly, given the problems that we do have in our state.
Madam Chair?
Representative Scott.
Thank you. So the reason that this bill is before us is really just the data provisions? Because the rest of it would fall under public safety, is that right?
Well, I think there, as with many of these bills, a little surprise, honestly, if you're suggesting maybe we shouldn't be hearing this bill as we've... I'm speaking. and I think, there is a lot of overlap with our criminal justice system and the judiciary system. And, I think it's fully appropriate for this bill to be within our jurisdiction. They're overlapping jurisdiction in all kinds of different bills, and this isn't any different.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't disagree with that statement. I think that really the only reason for this bill to be here today is the data provisions. And, we've been restricted on other bills to keep just to the provisions for the reason that the bill is in our committee and not go outside of that. And usually the testimony is directed in the same way, to just the provisions that are being taken up. But I don't know that I have any questions on the data provisions in this bill. What they outline in the bill is straightforward. And so other than that, I guess I would have one question for the bill's author, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Scott.
And I'm just wondering, Representative Gomez, if there's some place in our country, a city or a state that you think is doing police accountability the right way.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. I can't say that I've looked at every civilian oversight body that exists across the country. I think that a lot of cities like my city have tried various things. Most of them do not have the investigative powers that House File 640 would allow these bodies to have. Most of them have not had subpoena power, have not had the ability to issue independent findings of fact. And I'm not, you know, again, this is all if they're empowered by the governing body, but the piece about direct imposition of discipline, I think, is particularly gives this these bodies some teeth. I've heard good things about the civilian oversight body that some good things about the Los Angeles civilian oversight body that went into place after Rodney King. I mean, again, this has been an issue for decades and decades. We've been dealing with these entities. I know of a proposal in Chicago that takes a more expansive view of civilian overview. Civilian oversight that basically is sort of more like a mini city council that really puts, you know, instead of having the ultimate power rest with the mayor or a governing body, it rests with this independent, elected by the people, police oversight body. So, you know, I think there are some proposals that are doing all right. I think that generally, I guess I haven't seen a lot of, you know, in the course of many murders or killings or whatever, deaths at the hands of police, especially of Black men, I don't think that community has seen justice from these bodies broadly. I think that's why you see so many going to the courts for, you know, some type of remedy. I don't know if that helps somewhat, but that's sort of my kind of view of the way these operate around the country a little bit.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wondered if the bill's author has any data on cities or entities that have adopted a policy like this and what the data is showing as far as has it cut down on police involved uses of force or police involved deaths.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. I don't have data on other bodies that have these specific powers in front of me. You know, it's sort of more part of the as I said in my statement, it's like part of the intent with these is really about building sort of some legitimacy from the perspective of community. And I know that in San Francisco has a civilian police commission that has these powers that community generally kind of thinks works well. I wonder, Madam Chair, I know that one of my testifiers is kind of an expert on these matters, and so she would probably have more expansive view of the national picture if Ms. Gross could speak to Representative Scott's question briefly.
Ms. Gross.
Yes. San Francisco uses a model of civilian oversight that involves a civilian commissioner who oversees both the police and the civilian review authority in that area. And after they instituted that model in about almost nearly 20 years ago, they saw a very significant decrease in the number of lawsuits for excessive force, as well as a greater than 50% reduction in the actual use of force. And so, San Francisco offers a very good model that we should all consider. And it's not completely parallel to this model, because this model would just create a portion of that particular model, which is the civilian oversight portion of that model. Their model goes further by having, again, a civilian commissioner that is over both police and the civilian review authority. Thank you,
Ms. Gross. Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, I'd be interested in seeing the data out of San Francisco on that. I'll conclude with my questions right now and have other members if they wish to ask questions. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Representative Scott. And I will just note to your earlier comments that, you know, we have run a pretty tight ship throughout this legislative session, but there are exceptions to every rule. And I think given the need for the community to have an outlet to speak about how these laws and these potential bills would impact them is incredibly important in this moment. And as the chair of the committee, I have decided to make that a priority. So that is the reason we're having public testimony and part of the reason that we're having these conversations right now. Representative Mortensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for holding this hearing and allowing these bills to see the light of day. I appreciate that. I think there's some pretty good stuff in front of us. I kind of want to just, I have a couple of statements here, and I think Representative Scott had a good question on, are there maybe examples of police departments that are doing things right? And I would prop up my police station in Shakopee. I think that's a great example of a police department that's doing things right. In the last 5 years, they have won, and I'm reading from this other computer here, that the Shakopee Police Department is recognized for its initiative, innovation, and excellence in law enforcement practices in the areas of community safety, emerging issues, investigations, leadership, national security, transnational crime, and transportation safety. Second time in 5 years that our department won the International Association of Chiefs of Police Award. And so with that in mind, I thought, well, I'm going to reach out to our chief of police, who is clearly doing things well, and to see if he supported this bill. And he came back and had the same issues with the bill that I had, actually. He is not in favor of the bill. Maybe some communities could really benefit from something like this, excuse me. But I think the mandate is the issue here. And I agree there are broken relationships, as somebody said, but I don't think that holds true across the entire state. So I think we should let this exist at the local level and let local communities decide if something like this is something that makes the most sense for them instead of forcing a mandate down the throats of the entire state. So I can't be supporting the bill today, but I appreciate the thought.
Well, Representative Mortensen, you will be glad to learn that in the DE amendment that we put on the bill, it was made permissive. There is no mandate. If you look at line 1.17 of the DE amendment, a local unit of government may establish a civilian council and grant the council these authorities. So this is completely up to the local communities if this is something that they wish to do. Let's see, Representative Frazier, it looks like maybe that was, do you have additional questions, Representative?
I do, you bring up a great point. So how is that different from right now? Are you saying that right now communities don't have the ability to do this?
Chair Gomez.
Yeah, thank you, Representative, or thank you, Chair Beckerfin and Representative Mortensen. So as I mentioned in 2012, there was language added to statute. If you look in the DE amendment, starting on line 1.17, it kind of refers to it. So currently, statute expressly prohibits a civilian review board or body from issuing findings of fact, which means that they don't have the ability to conduct an independent investigation. They don't have the ability to subpoena anybody for testimony. So they're completely relying on information that's provided to them by the police department to issue any, you know, to make any recommendations to the CLIO about actions that they should take. And so this is really about this, frankly, I mean, was, it took all the teeth away from civilian oversight that ever existed in the state of Minnesota. It was an intentional effort to do so. And so this undoes that.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, thank you.
Representative Mortensen, any further follow-up?
No, that's it. I appreciate the clarification.
All right. With that, Chair Gomez, any closing comments on the bill?
No, I just really, I thank you and Madam Chair and the members of the committee for creating this space today to have this conversation and
and to hear from community. And, you know, like I said, if you support, you know, policing as an institution, I believe that this is a bill that you should support. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Chair Gomez. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 640 as amended be recommended to be placed on the general register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Beckerfin.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
No.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Fang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang. Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Okay. There are 11 ayes and 6 nays.
With 11 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails and House File 640 as amended is on its way to the general register. Due to one of the testifier schedules, we're actually going to do House File 1104 next. This is a Representative Thompson bill. Representative Thompson, welcome to the committee. I will move your bill, House File 1104, be recommended to be placed on the general register. Your bill is now before us. Representative Thompson, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members. House File 1104 is kind of controversial to some, but not to people who are close up to, although people don't want to hear it, these police-involved murders is what we're witnessing. And I want to share, in 2016, we lost Philando Castile. I spoke with Philando on July 5th of 2016, and we talked about the murder of Alton Sterling right in front of the store, numb to these police-involved murders. And the very next day after talking to Philando about the murder of Alton Sterling, ultimately, my friend, my good friend, Philando Castile, was murdered in Falcon Heights, Minnesota, by police officer Geronimo Yanez. House File 1104 is the qualified immunity bill. You know, qualified immunity is a judicial doctrine that protects public officials from liability when they violate people's constitutional right. Unless those rights were clearly established at the time of their violation, the Supreme Court invented qualified immunity. This is in 1967, and it was strengthened in 1982 to what we have today. The purpose for this House file before us is to seek an end to qualified immunity as a defense for law enforcement, providing accountability to communities across the state of Minnesota. First, it will return the Constitution to its proper place as a limit on government actions by making it possible for these individuals to enforce the Constitution against law enforcement officers. Second, it would change the structural incentives for governments at all levels, law enforcement included, encouraging them to take more responsibility for the actions of their employees. And since, you know, law enforcement insurance, I mean, since the state's insurance companies almost always pay the bill when an officer is found personally liable for violating someone's right, if qualified immunity was removed, we would be able to force these higher premiums unless they took an active role in reducing your civil and constitutional rights violations. And for police, this might include providing more training and instituting robust use of force policies. In other words, a world without a qualified immunity would mean that we'd be in a world where government has a stake in making sure that law enforcement follows the Constitution. And I have a couple of testifiers, but this is pretty much the meat and potatoes of this.
All right, thank you, Representative Thompson. We'll move on to public testimony. First, we're going to go to Professor Gregory Sisk from St. Thomas School of Law. You could introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin and members of the committee. And thank you, Chair, for accommodating me. I had a class scheduled, but there are some things that are more important. So I have now moved that class and will remain available both to testify and to answer any questions that the committee might have. My name is Gregory Sisk, and I hold the Loggie Distinguished Chair in Law at the University of St. Thomas. I am speaking solely for myself and not on behalf of the university. I have written books and scholarly articles on lawsuits to hold the government accountable for official wrongdoing. I have practiced on both sides of these issues as a former U.S. Department of Justice attorney, and now in pro bono litigation on behalf of those harmed by official abuse. And today I want to highlight the growing scholarly consensus that qualified immunity is illegitimate and has been an abysmal failure as a legal doctrine. I will be very brief and summarize only. Qualified immunity has failed as history. Professor William Baud at the University of Chicago and Professor James Fander at Northwestern have done the historical research to show that there was never a good faith exception that allowed officials to ignore the Constitution. Justice Clarence Thomas recently cited to that very historical evidence to question qualified immunity as a doctrine created by freewheeling judicial activism. Qualified immunity has failed as constitutional law. It has hollowed out constitutional rights, leaving some victims of unconstitutional official misconduct without any remedy. And qualified immunity has failed as protection for police acting reasonably. Police officers who are acting in difficult and dangerous situations already receive broad and deferential treatment under reasonableness provisions in the Constitution. As Professor Joanne Schwartz of UCLA showed in an empirical study, eliminating qualified immunity will not open floodgates to huge numbers of new lawsuits. No officer acting with objective reasonableness will be held liable if we go back to the original understandings of the Constitution and eliminate qualified immunity. I want to emphasize that qualified immunity is a subject on which legal scholars across the spectrum have come together to recognize its failures. We legal scholars hotly debate issues with each other, and seldom do we reach a single consensus. This is that exceptional scenario. Law professors who belong to the liberal-leaning American Constitution Society, law professors who advocate major structural changes in public safety, and other law professors like myself who belong to the Federalist Society and who oppose defunding the police, find themselves coming together on this issue. We share a scholarly and intellectual agreement that qualified immunity is wrong and does not work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor. I hope that at a minimum, maybe you ask your students to watch committee today. We will move on to the next testifier. I have Jonathan McClellan. And I'll just note, we've got a couple testifiers on this bill as well as the next one. And we do have two more bills to discuss after this. So we'll just ask our testifiers to be respectful of the time of other testifiers moving forward. With that, Mr. McClellan, please introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Jonathan McClellan. I am a retired Minneapolis firefighter, retired due to an injury in the line of duty saving a young man's life. I am president of the Minnesota Justice Coalition and law student at the University of St. Thomas. We are also part of the Minnesota Coalition Justice for George Floyd and All Stolen Lives. I would like to thank this committee for giving me an opportunity to share with you today. I would like to thank Representative Thompson for carrying this historic piece of legislation. The testimony that I give is based on fact, history, and constitutional law and case law. In the Civil Rights Act of 1871, Congress, an elected representative of the people, gave Americans the right to sue public officials who violate their rights. Congress said that if a public official violates your rights, whether via police brutality, an illegal search, or an unlawful arrest, you can file a lawsuit to hold that public official financially accountable for his conduct. Congress made it possible to seek redress in the courts. In 1967, a year before the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., The Supreme Court invented qualified immunity in the case Pearson versus Ray, describing it as a modest exception for public officials who had acted in good faith and believed that their conduct was authorized by law. In 1982, in Harlow versus Fitzgerald, the court expanded that defense. The protection afforded to public officials would no longer turn on whether the officials acted in good faith. Now even officials who violate people's rights maliciously will be immune unless the victim can show that his or her right was clearly established. To show that the law is clearly established, the court has said a victim must point to a previously decided case that involves the same specific context and particular conduct. Unless the victim can point to a judicial decision that happened to involve the same context and conduct, the officer will be shielded from liability. The Supreme Court has recognized one exception to this rule in Hope v. Pilzer. There, corrections officials disciplined a prisoner by handcuffing him to a hitching post for 7 hours with his hands above his shoulders, shirtless in the summer sun. At one point, a guard taunted the prisoner by giving water to a guard dog in plain sight. Faced with these circumstances and no prior case that had confronted similar facts, the Supreme Court ruled that the officer's cruelty was so obvious that they should have had fair warning that their conduct violated constitutional protection against cruel and unusual punishment. Far from creating meaningful exception, however, courts frequently consider the circumstances and hope to set the threshold for how egregious an officer's behavior must be before he is considered to have fair warning, and this is the law today. Qualified immunity chills constitutional rights of citizens. Qualified immunity freezes constitutional law. As mentioned previously, in order to overcome a defense of qualified immunity, a victim must show that the law enforcement violated clearly established law by pointing to a case arising in the same context and involving the same conduct. This has given courts a shortcut to resolving cases. Instead of reviewing, analyzing, and applying constitutional doctrine to determine whether a person's rights were violated, a court can instead simply say that there has been no sufficiently similar case in the past. The result is that fewer courts ever resolve constitutional issues, and constitutional rights are hardly ever clearly established. Qualified immunity is not a law created by an elected body, such as Congress and/or a state legislature. It is a duty of an elected body to enact law and the courts to interpret the law. This has happened in our history before, where the court invented a doctrine that harmed a now protected class of people. U.S. Chief Justice Roger Taney invented a doctrine of substantive due process, a complete contradiction in terms, and used it to extend slavery throughout the U.S. territory. Chief Justice Taney was known for one of the worst court decisions in U.S. history in the Dred Scott case. Along with other events in the 1860s, elected officials rose to that challenge and enacted the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Courts are not allowed to make law. That is the job of a duly elected body represented by the people. Qualified immunity means that victims of brutality or harassment by law enforcement generally get no relief in court and have no ability to hold offending officers accountable for their actions. Ending qualified immunity would mean a place where the government makes sure their employees follow the Constitution and their oaths to the Constitution have meaning. Ending qualified immunity would change structural incentives for government at all levels, encourage them to take more responsibility for their actions of their employees and ensure best hiring practices. For police, ending qualified immunity might include providing de-escalation training and instituting robust use of force policies that help our police departments evolve. Qualified immunity lowers the standard of liability lower than any other profession. Qualified immunity has created deep mistrust between communities and law enforcement. A fear tactic used is the fear of rampant lawsuits against police. These are overblown. Many municipalities indemnify their officers, meaning that the city pays and for any settlement, not the officers themselves. Another fear tactic used is that prohibiting qualified immunity will cause officers to second-guess their actions. Police officers' actions should be based on their training, and their training based on following the Constitution and state law. And we want good officers to follow the law, not make excuses to get around it. Qualified immunity sends the message that the police are above the law, and nobody is above the law. In a case that became before the 11th Circuit, a police officer shot a 10-year-old while trying to shoot a non-threatening family dog. The 11th Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals held that the officer was entitled to qualified immunity because no earlier case held it was unconstitutional for a police officer to recklessly fire his gun into a group of children without justification. The court also declined to establish that rule. Not only was the officer let off the hook in this case, but the very same officer could act the same way again and would still be entitled to qualified immunity. In Kane v. Barger in 2018, Officer Shane Barger was dispatched to a hospital to interview a sexual assault victim. A physician had already taken photos of the victim's injuries during the medical examination. During the interview, Barger instructed the victim to come to the police department with the clothes she was wearing at the time of the assault. Upon arrival at the police department, Barger took the victim alone to a back room and photographed intimate areas of her body. The victim claimed that Barger touched her upper chest and her buttocks as he photographed her with his personal cell phone. Barger questioned the victim about her breasts, vagina, and buttocks, persistently asking whether she sustained injuries to her vagina. Though she repeatedly denied having visible injuries, Barger's relentless questioning led her to show her vagina to him. Barger initially lied to investigators about using his cell phone to photograph the victim. After further questioning, he admitted he had lied, explaining he didn't want his girlfriend to be jealous of the photos. Barger was disciplined for violating department policy, and he received a two-week suspension. The victim then sued Officer Barger, alleging he touched her and photographed her for his own gratification. A district court granted qualified immunity to Barger, ruling that the right to be free from violation of bodily integrity was not clearly established. In the case of
Mr. McClellan, I'm just going to ask you to wrap up. We've gotten well over 5 minutes, and we do have other testifiers that need to be given some time as well.
Yep.
Go ahead.
In the case of Jessup v. City of Fresno, Ninth Circuit granted immunity to a police officer who were alleged to have stolen over $225,000 in cash and rare coins while executing a search warrant. Obviously, these officers were not acting in good faith, and no one contended otherwise. But the court said that while the theft of personal property by police officers sworn to uphold the law may be morally wrong, the officers couldn't be sued for their theft because that particular appellate court had never specifically decided whether the theft of property covered by the terms of a search warrant and seized pursuant to that warrant violates the Fourth Amendment. So because there was no prior case involving such outlandishly illegal misconduct, the officers received qualified immunity. An officer who knowingly violates someone's constitutional rights will generally be protected from suit unless the victim can identify previous judicial opinions that addressed the specific context and conduct. This is very far afield from what Congress sought to achieve in the Civil Rights Act. Instead of considering whether a person's civil rights have been violated, and if so, providing that victim with a remedy, courts shut the door to victims simply because no prior judicial opinion happened to involve the same facts. On March 3rd, 2021, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act in H.R. 1280 in the 117th Congress. As part of this act, qualified immunity was included. Since last year, Colorado, New York, Connecticut, and just this past week, New Mexico, have instituted qualified immunity provisions in their law. As I've stated in previous testimony, there is no silver bullet for fixing the deep wounds needed around criminal justice reform, but supporting this bill sends a mighty powerful message that we are a nation of laws founded on constitutional principles of which we all benefit as Americans, and it is what separates us from any other country in the world. This is our Dred Scott moment, and the state of Minnesota looks to you. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, we have Angela Myers. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Hello, everyone. My name is Angela Myers. I am the president of the Minneapolis NAACP. I will try to keep my comments brief. And my main comment I'm going to say is that I join with the NAACP, the national NAACP, NAACPs across the nation, from Virginia to California, with the call for ending qualified immunity in our country and in our states. I support HF 1109, as well as does the NAACP's position of supporting ending qualified immunity, not just on these local levels, but also we're fighting for it on the federal level as well. And 2020 HR 7120, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, was voted in at the U.S. House of Representatives by a margin of 236 yays to 181 nays on 6/25/2020. The NAACP supported this bill, and in Minnesota, 5 out of 8 congresspeople representatives also voted in favor of the NAACP's position. And the major, major point of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act was ending, is ending qualified immunity. And so this is something that I find that already we are as a body, as Minnesotans, as representatives of Minnesotans are already pushing for on all levels. So it is clear that we need to do this here now. And as 5 out of 8 Congress people, Angela Craig, Dean Phillips, Betty McCullum, Ilhan Omar, as well as Colin Peterson, that represent all parts of our states, all different regions. This goes to show that not only do our representatives at Congress believe in ending qualified immunity, but I would say as a community leader that community members, this is the number one priority for community members that I speak to on a daily basis. When you ask them, what is the bill? What do you want to see? What policy do you want to see change? The number one response that I get as a community leader is ending qualified immunity. When it comes to ending police brutality, one of the things that community members want to see is accountability. And this is what accountability means. And this is what the accountability policies that they want to see. And this is what we're talking about. So I just want to map from the regular day person in the street to Congress, we all are pushing for ending qualified immunity. So it's really upon you all to make the decision today to push this forward on the local level, on the state level, because we need to see this and we need to see ending qualified immunity today, right now, as we don't have time for Congress. We don't have time for the Senate. We don't have time for these things to trickle down to Minnesota. I believe that this is a moment in time, like in 1921, when Minnesota passed the first anti-lynching bill ever in the nation, for Minnesota to stand up again and pass real police legislation and really take a stand nationally in saying that we will not let acts of police violence be held unaccountable. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up, we have Reverend Dr. Ronald Bell. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Sure. Greetings. I'm Reverend Dr. Ron Bell II. I am a husband of 11 years, a pastor of 12 years, a father of 2 beautiful, energetic Black boys, a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. And a resident of St. Paul. I'm also here alongside Isaiah. And in addition to my work of pastoring, I also do a lot of work in leading, writing, and leading communities, organizations, and individuals around race, trauma, and empathy and grief. And I really want to talk today, just for a couple seconds, about this issue of trauma and looking at qualified immunity from the perspective of a mental health perspective. And to do so in this way, that when someone experiences trauma, internally our digestive systems are corrupted, our immune systems are affected, our ability to think critically is affected, and externally our relationships are affected, how we relate to others, our community, and so forth. all of that is able to be mitigated, to be regulated, to be healed if we begin by acknowledging the trauma, removing the harm, empowering the individual to have some agency, and then creating process, procedures, and structures that help to further their healing. Well, qualified immunity robs the individual of the ability to mitigate their own trauma. Because what qualified immunity does is says that there can be no closure and there can be no justice for the harm that was experienced by the individual. And so when we think about what that does to communities, knowing that that there's no way to hold accountable the police officers for harms that have been caused, it just continues that trauma episode. It becomes generational, and we begin to see its effect in our community. And so for me, ending qualified immunity is a mental health need for our community. And so I'm here in support of HF 1104. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Last on the list, I have Director Rose. If you could introduce yourself again for the record and then go ahead with your testimony, please.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. This is Theodore Rose with CEMA. Simply put, qualified immunity is a roadblock against justice and accountability. A just law should not be inconsistent. The state can either protect civil rights or allow officers to commit civil rights violations with impunity. The state cannot have it both ways. CEMA supports this bill because ending qualified immunity allows the state to take a major step toward equal treatment of peace officers and their alleged victims. We thank you for the opportunity to speak again, and we thank Representative Thompson for authoring this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. That is all I've got for testifiers on the list. Again, we'll remind members that there is also written testimony available that has been submitted to the committee and is available publicly for folks to review as well. We will move to member discussion. Representative Mortensen.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a handful of questions and some comments for the author here. And I know we're probably pressed for time, so I'll try to keep this quick and try to cut to the point. I favor the idea of eliminating qualified immunity, and I hear a lot of the testifiers saying the same thing, but I think we need to be honest, as now this bill does, at least not to the scope that I think a lot of testifiers are looking for. This bill only ends qualified immunity for police officers, which is asking a different standard of police officers than is what is being asked of every other government agent across the state. So my question is, and then I have another issue with the bill. So my question for Representative Thompson is, this bill states that failing to intervene, somebody could be liable. And I think we've all seen the video of Dante Wright by now, and the officer that shot, just to her right, there was another officer. And I fear that, as written, that officer to her right would be held liable for not intervening when, frankly, there is very little time. And I don't think we should hold people liable for not acting, but I do favor holding people accountable who are doing the acting. So my two questions for the author is, would you entertain an amendment to broaden the scope and make it all agents of government? Because I don't want any mayors, any public school teachers, any the governor, the legislature to infringe upon anybody's constitutional right. So would you expand it to include all government agents? And would you remove this failing to intervene portion?
Representative Thompson.
Here, respectfully, absolutely not. All government agents aren't killing people in the middle of the streets. All government agencies aren't getting away with murder. I haven't seen a doctor yet mistakenly put morphine in somebody's IV and say, oh my God, I made a mistake. I haven't seen that yet. But what I have saw is several of these snuff videos where these officers are obviously violating not only people's constitutional rights, but their human rights. And then using the law to protect them while calling themselves upholding the law. And so, no, I respectfully will not submit to an amendment to this bill. It has to be firm. And we want to make Minnesota first, not worse, when it comes to police reform. And so respectfully, no.
All right. Moving on to Representative Scott.
I didn't get an answer to my other question.
Representative Mortensen, we're moving on. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the bill's author, does this law apply just to on-duty officers, or would this apply to officers who are not on duty?
Representative Thompson.
Representative Scott, the bill, as you're looking at it, I don't know. We interpret things differently, but one thing we do interpret is the way this bill is read, and it says exactly what it means. There is no hidden messages in this, off duty, on duty. So I'm not trying to like go through the smoke screens. You clearly know what this bill means.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, I actually don't know the answer to that question. So if the bill's author is not willing to articulate that for me, maybe House Research could.
Yep, I believe the language in the bill is any officer under color of law. But if House Research could weigh in to clarify for folks what that means.
Madam Chair.
Yep, go ahead, Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, so yes, the bill requires the actor to be acting under color of law. I don't know exactly what that would mean in terms of on-duty or off-duty police officers, but there has to be some connection to state activity and to the state in order to be acting under color of law.
All right, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it isn't really all that clear. And so my other question is, I know last summer in the police reform package of bills that we passed, something to do with a duty to intervene. And so I'm just wondering the passage of that law intermingles or whatever with this proposed language. So I don't know if the bill author wants to answer that or if he wants House Research to answer that, but I'm just wondering how those two things work together.
Representative Thompson, or we can go to Mr. Hopkins again.
Respectfully, Chair, I would like Jonathan McClellan to answer that question.
Got it. Mr. McClellan, please go ahead with your response.
Yep, and I'm going to defer the question to Professor Sisk. Thank you.
All right. Every good student knows when to defer to their professor, so Professor Sisk.
Well, let me begin with the color of state law question. That is not something new that is in this bill. That is the longstanding standard that has applied since just after the Civil War. This bill does not change that rule. It does not add anything to that rule. It doesn't respond to that rule. It simply follows that rule. What's different about this bill is removing the judicially imposed qualified immunity standard that was added by Supreme Court activism in the 1960s.
Representative Scott, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure that answered my question. My question to the professor, in case he didn't hear it, originally had to do with the bill that we passed last year that had to do with a duty to intervene, that other officers that were present had a duty to intervene if they saw another officer, behaving incorrectly or against policy or law. And so how does that work with the language in this bill that addresses a duty to intervene?
I'm actually going to go to Mr. Diebel in House Research, since I think he was involved in the drafting of that last year as well as this bill. So Mr. Diebel.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I have to admit, we did create a duty to intervene that's imposed on law enforcement last summer. That was enacted into law, and that is actually being modified in the public safety omnibus bill this session, House Public Safety Omnibus Bill. And so other than that, I can say that there is now in place a duty to intercede, but I frankly haven't looked at how it interplays with this law or this proposal, other than it exists now in statute.
Got it. Mr. Diebel, if you could follow up with the committee and get that information to Ms. Ghanani, or that would be helpful. Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair and members, so this bill creates an analog of federal Section 1983 actions. And in a federal Section 1983 action, a peace officer's failure to intervene to prevent a constitutional violation can give rise to liability under a federal Section 1983 lawsuit. So this is doing the same thing at the state level. It's not directly connected to the policy proposal that the policy was passed by the legislature regarding police officers' ability or a duty to intervene here, but the bill says that an officer can also be held liable for failure to intervene to prevent a constitutional violation, and that is analogous to what currently exists under federal law and federal Section 1983 actions.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Representative Scott, and then I want to move on to Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll conclude my questioning.
All right, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Thompson or perhaps Mr. Hopkins. So we've had a lot of discussion about violation of constitutional rights, and Mr. Hopkins just alluded again to the federal Section 1983, which discussed constitutional violations. But I just have concern in the language. It says deprivation of any rights, privileges or immunities granted to a person under the Constitution and laws. So this seems much broader than the federal or state constitutional rights. And I just wondered, does it apply to any violation of any privilege under any law, federal or state? Thank you.
Representative Thompson.
Chair, I want to refer back to Jonathan McCullough.
Go ahead, Mr. McClellan.
I would defer that to Professor Sist again. Respectfully. Thank you.
All right, Professor Sisk.
Section 1983 often is talked about in terms of constitutional violations, but it protects civil rights generally. So if an individual has rights that come from statutory law, deprivation of those rights is protected under a Section 1983 action as well. And a qualified immunity addition to that would say that it's not enough to have violated the statutory or constitutional rights. It has to have been something stated in a particular Supreme Court or Court of Appeals precedent that involved the same specific kinds of facts. So this is parallel to the federal 1983 provision.
Follow-up, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Professor Sisk. And so does the federal 1983 statute also extend to privileges and immunities?
Professor Sisk.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. Yes, the language in Section 1983, and I'll read it here, it applies to the deprivation of any rights, privileges, or immunities secured by the Constitution and laws. So what is stated in this provision is directly parallel to that. So this is not something new that's being invented by this legislative proposal. The only thing that this legislative proposal does that is different than Section 1983 is make explicit what is not in Section 1983, that there is no qualified immunity.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Representative Robbins. Representative Mortensen, I see you've got your hand up again. You can ask one more question and then we're going to move to it.
One more, huh? Well, that was my question, maybe. All right, well, I have a question for Professor Sisk. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the right to life the only constitutionally guaranteed right of every Minnesotan?
Professor Sisk.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. I'm not exactly sure how to answer that question. The rights that are guaranteed under the Constitution are those that are found in the Bill of Rights. In addition, again, as that Section 1983 provides, and this parallel statute would provide, any other civil rights that are granted by the democratic process through Congress or a legislature enacting it. Yes, the right to life is certainly a part of what's protected by the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment.
Great. All right. I will. There are no amendments filed to this bill. I will renew my motion that House File 1104 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller. Representative Moeller. Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel.
No.
Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Regrettably, no.
Representative Navani. Representative Votney, no. Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Fang.
Aye.
Representative Sean.
Aye.
Perfect. There are 9 ayes and 7 nays.
All right, with 9 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails. House File 1104 is recommended to be placed on the General Register. Moving right along to another Representative Thompson bill, we have House Bill 1103. Thank you, Representative Thompson. I will move your bill. House Bill 1103 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. Your bill is now before us, but I believe you do have an author's amendment, the A2 amendment. I will go ahead and move the A2 amendment. This is an amendment that clarifies that video and audio may be redacted as required by the law, but cannot be edited. So it's similar to the language that's currently in the Public Safety Omnibus Bill. So I will move that A2 amendment. Representative Thompson, would you like to add anything regarding the A2 amendment?
No, sir.
All right. We'll move to a voice vote. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 All those opposed? All right, the A2 amendment is adopted. We now have the bill before us as amended. Representative Thompson, please tell us about your bill.
Well, House File 1103 is duties imposed on peace officers and law enforcement agencies regarding video and audio of deadly use of force and civil rights, civil remedy provided. It allows families access within 48 hours to view this body-worn camera footage in police critical incidents, and requires, as amended, video be available for copying after 90 days by descendants of next of kin. Families of people killed by police wait several months to up to a year now or more before they can view this footage that would allow them to know how their loved ones died. A lot of times there's something to hide in these, I call them snuff videos is what I call them, because that's what we're seeing on these police-involved murders. The purpose of 1104 is to restore the balance, 1103, I'm sorry, is to restore the balance in Minnesota's Government Data Practices Act by making this footage available to families of the people killed by police officers. And with that, Chair, I have Jonathan McCollum also.
All right, thank you, Representative Thompson. We do have a couple testifiers. Mr. McClellan, if you could reintroduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony. Keeping in mind, we've got about 40 minutes left in committee today, and we've got one other bill to discuss. So, Mr. McClellan.
Promise I'll be less than 5 minutes. Hello, my name is Jonathan McClellan. I'm the president of the Minnesota Justice Coalition. and law student at the University of St. Thomas. I would like to thank this committee for giving me an opportunity to share with you today. I would also like to thank Representative Thompson for carrying this important piece of legislation. The common thread that you hear throughout all the families' cases who lost loved ones to police violence is that information is kept by law enforcement, and the information sought often stalls out potential cases, and the family is left to suffer not knowing what truly happened to their loved one. You should not have to wait 10 months or 11 years to know what happened when your loved one is killed. One case in particular which inspired this legislation is the case of Kobe Heisler. Kobe Heisler was a young autistic boy who was killed in Brooklyn Center in his grandparents' home by law enforcement on August 31st, 2019, following a mental health incident. This is the same city where Dante Wright was killed. While meeting with many other families who lost loved ones at the hands of law enforcement, Kobe's mother, Amity, was notified that she would be allowed to see the footage from her son's death. This happened to be 1 week after the death of George Floyd. In early June 2020, almost 10 months after the death of Kobe, Amity was told that the only people that could see the law enforcement videos were her family, and then that changed the day of the scheduled viewing. To add to her pain and grief of losing her son, Amity was overcome with grief to the point where she was unable to stand. She was not allowed a chance to properly grieve for her son because she was kept in the dark on what really happened. There are many similar cases when it comes to families requesting information. These families are put on a yo-yo trying to figure out what happened to their loved one, and oftentimes this goes on for years. In another case, we are still receiving contradictory information after 11 years of being told that it didn't exist. We were able to find a video. In a recent case out of Minneapolis, the police released one video to justify the killing of a man named Dalat Eid, allowing that narrative to simmer in the community while holding on to all the cards, rebuffing the family's pleas for transparency and access to all the video while the family is still grieving. As a state, we can do better. To prove this, after the tragic killing of Dante Wright, the police released the video within 24 hours and allowed the family to view it in less than 20. On Saturday, March 20th, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman told a working group of 16, including Attorney General Keith Ellison and Minnesota Commissioner of Public Safety John Harrington, regarding any police-involved deadly force encounters, that any video related to the death of a citizen should be made public as soon as possible, but in all cases within 45 days of the incident. When law enforcement agencies withhold video evidence of police behavior, the other details concerning the deceased are usually released shortly after the incident. The decedent's prior criminal record, whether or not the person possessed drugs, the blood test results, and the coroner's report are made available to the media. The priority of the families gets lost in this process, and that needs to change. Families should be number one. Oftentimes, when the video and or audio is released by law enforcement, it will be selective in spinning a narrative in the media that benefits one side. Oftentimes, these media dumps are misleading and cast a negative shadow on the person who was killed, forcing the families to fight an uphill battle to clear their loved one's name while trying to grieve and seek justice. As part of his earlier statement, Mike Freeman said, "We share these remarks with a profound commitment to deal fairly, transparently, and professionally as we can in each case. We assign our most experienced people and allocate all the resources necessary to reach justice. These families need to be allowed access to this information to manage their trauma and pursue justice in whatever form it may come. This club's membership is unsolicited and paid in tears and sometimes in blood. It is important to ensure that transparency and trust is the bedrock and or foundation of our government institutions, and any opportunity we have to improve, we should. This bill will help advance those very principles that are prerequisite for transparency and accountability to the families and communities in which they live." Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McClellan. Next on the list, I have Michelle Gross. Please reintroduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, and I'll keep my comments very short. My name is Michelle Gross, and thank you, Chair Beckerfin and members, for allowing me to testify again. And again, I'm the president of Communities United Against Police Brutality. I'm not gonna reiterate the things that Jonathan already talked about. I do wanna mention one thing, however. Under Minnesota Statute 13.82 Subdivision 2, already several data elements are designated as, quote, public at all times in the originating agencies. in any kinds of police critical incidents, and frankly, in any arrestable incident. However, under Minnesota statute 13.825, body-worn camera footage has been treated as a carve-out. The purpose of House File 1103 is to restore balance by making this footage available to the families, I want to emphasize that, of people killed by police. While law enforcement has tried to conflate those families with the general public, they have a distinctly different interests, particularly an interest in knowing what happened to their family members at the hands of police. I want to quickly read a short passage in an order that we recently received in a lawsuit in which Minneapolis had denied us timely access to the names of officers who had shot a community member to death. And it's a quick little passage, but I think it absolutely applies to this circumstance. The court notes for the record that these cases, officer-involved shootings, the reasons for the public to have immediate access to specific information, such as the names of the officers, is compelling. Our common humanity tells us that we owe at least this much to the surviving family members. In her affidavit, Michelle Gross, president of CUAPB, explains that one media strategy often used by law enforcement agencies in the immediate aftermath of officer-involved killings is to vilify the victim. She explains that to be on a level playing field with such agencies, the families of those killed and the public have to have immediate access to critical information about the shooting. The court agrees. The court is persuaded that the families of the dead and maimed are entitled to immediately know the names of those responsible. And again, that's related to the names of officers involved in the shooting, but I think the very same rationale applies to the video footage of those killings. These words by Judge Bridget Sullivan are important because they recognize the humanity of the families and their need to know what happened to their loved ones. I urge passage of this statute, or rather this bill, so that we can ensure that the families of loved ones who are impacted by police deadly force incidents have at least a way to know in a timely manner what has happened to their loved ones. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Last on the list, I have Theodore Rose. Please go ahead with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. This is Theodore Rose again with CEMA. We believe that the key thing here is that Minnesotans deserve to know, see, and hear the truth. So CEMA supports this bill because it will empower families in their struggle for truth and justice and accountability after a deadly force or a deadly use of force incident involving their loved ones. That's the key struggle going on in the community, as we've been saying throughout this session. And so we urge the committee to empower families by requiring the release of the recordings within 2 days. I wanna thank the chair again for the opportunity to speak, and I thank Representative Thompson for authoring this bill. Thank you.
Fires, thank you for your testimony. We do not have, I think I'm good now. thank you for your testimony. We don't have anyone else on the list. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first to Mr. Rose, I'm not sure what CMA stands for. Could he tell, he just says CMA and I'm like, what's CMA?
The Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I think he introduced himself that way on the first bill, but yeah, good to ask that question if you're not sure.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Thompson, I don't know if you know this or not, but I worked extensively on the body camera laws that we have in place right now. And I've had conversations with Ms. Gross. I've had conversations with the NAACP. I've had these people in my office. I've talked to them because we worked hard for a couple of years to try to get the right policy on body cams and to make it balanced and fair. And believe it or not, we were in the majority and I did not get my way necessarily on the policy. But we felt that it was important to have the right balance. And so there are many stakeholders involved with that. And there's never a problem coming back and looking at a at a law years later to see how it's working out. I'd never have a problem doing that. I do believe that the families in most cases are able to see these videos. And I think the body camera video or the body camera laws were passed in 2016. And I had a conversation with my own sheriff last night and said, would there be a way if we added to statute that that a law enforcement agency could share with the family within a certain amount of time the video of what happened to their loved one, and maybe put some guardrails around that to say that as long as it didn't interfere with an investigation or something to that effect. And so he said, absolutely, I think that there's a conversation to be had there. And I think that most law enforcement agencies, and I know that one of your testifiers said that that's not always the case, but many law enforcement agencies are already doing that. They understand the importance of the family being able to see, you know, what happened. And the other parts of the bill, I mean, I don't think anybody argues with the fact that those videos should not be tampered with. They should not be edited in any way except for to redact images of people that you can't find them to get their permission to have their images viewed. So my question, I guess, to the bill's author, is that anything that appeals to you as sort of something to work on going forward to get the right balance in a bill like this?
Representative Thompson.
I think, thank you, Chair and Representative. I think there's some of these bills that we work on, especially when it has to do with law enforcement. Some of them are well-intended bills, right? And some of them are well-intended. But then what happens is a well-intended bill, a well-intended statute, a well-intended house file turns around and it harms a certain community while well-intended. It harms, and by no means am I interested in doing any more than what we have before you right now? I guess the short answer is no.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm really sorry to hear that, because I feel like this is something that is important for the family members to be able to see what happened. But at the same time, I don't want to compromise an investigation or compromise, you know, I take even the incidents the court case that's going on right now regarding the death of George Floyd, and how it was very difficult to find a jury that could pass muster because there was so much publicity around it. And my fear is, especially with the language where you want to release the video to the family, a copy of it, my fear there is that it's going to taint any possible jury or potentially taint any possible jury selection, because the video would probably widely be put out to the general public, and therefore could, I don't know how you would ever find an objective jury. So I don't want to interfere with due process. I don't want someone, you know, I don't want to compromise in any way the justice system from having a fair hearing, having fair a fair trial in these cases. And I fear that with parts of this bill, that's what would happen. And I believe that there's a way forward with this bill to get you what you're wanting. Not everything in this bill is something that I think is in the best interest of even the victims, the potential, you know, any victims that this might happen to. And so, because I don't want somebody that would actually be guilty to get off because we couldn't find the right jury, because the jury pool was tainted because a video was out there. So, you know, I think that this could be worked on in good faith by all participants, but if you're not willing to do that, Representative Thompson, I'm sorry to hear that, because I think there is room for improvement on the existing law surrounding body-worn cameras, and I'll leave it at that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Not seeing any other questions, any closing comments, Representative Thompson?
I wanted to just ask Representative Scott a question, if I could.
You can, Representative Thompson, but I'll just remind you, we got one more bill going today, and I'm not sure if she's open to taking a question, but you can certainly ask.
Representative Scott, have you ever had anyone that you know killed by law enforcement?
Representative Scott.
No, I have not.
You couldn't imagine the pain that families and friends and loved ones feel when their family member is no longer, somebody won't be able to enjoy the 4th of July this year, and to withhold evidence to protect a law enforcement officer, to edit video, to draw a narrative that police officers are above the law, is what we're trying to prevent from happening here. Nobody wants to make law enforcement's job hard, but at the same time, we don't want to make it easy for law enforcement to get away with murder. And that's what we're seeing happen here in this state. The entire United States of America is watching the state of Minnesota right now. I want us to take bold steps in making sure that we put policy in place to hold these bad seeds accountable for when they create this. These incidences are making law enforcement hard, not policy to prevent these type of incidents from happening. These incidents that keep happening, you know, there's a hate for just the uniform. And some of these officers put on their uniform to make a difference in their community, and they're being hated also. And so, you know, bad policing makes good police officers look very bad. And so I want to make sure that we do everything that we can possibly do here in this legislative body to create an atmosphere where there's no room for bad policing, and then the bad apples will fall suit and leave, i.e. what we just saw in Minneapolis. And then the last thing I would just say, Chair, is if you would allow Michelle Gross just an opportunity to elaborate just a little bit more on what I'm saying, please. And then I'm done.
All right, Ms. Gross, I'll give you just a couple minutes, and then we do need to move to the vote.
I understand. Thank you very much. Representative Scott, it was my pleasure to work with you on our prior efforts to reach a balance with the body camera footage, and it was sad to me that we weren't able to actually achieve that balance. What this bill does is simply give families access to view the footage, and they could do that at a police station. I have worked with a number of families who've done that and that sort of thing. But I've also equally worked with a number of families who literally had no access to see what happened to their family member for over a year. This is excruciating for these families. And I think this bill draws the exact balance that you're looking for by allowing the families to view that footage, perhaps again in a police station or other appropriate setting. They're not being given a copy of that footage or anything. They're simply being allowed to see it for themselves. And it's not being shared then again with the general public. It's specific to the rights of families, and it recognizes their rights and creates the balance that I think we would both agree is necessary. So I thank you for allowing me to reflect that. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Gross. Always happy to have someone correct the record. Representative Scott, and then we are gonna move to the vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to correct the record here, this bill does allow for the family members to have a copy eventually after a certain amount of days. And so that's a problematic part of this bill. I'll leave it at that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scott. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1103 as amended be moved to the general register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Beckerfin.
Aye.
Representative Mueller?
Aye.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Price?
Aye.
Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Hur?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long? Representative Long? Representative Mortensen?
Aye.
Representative Novotny?
No.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Fang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
And Representative Long? Perfect. There are 10 ayes and 6 nays.
All right, with 10 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails. House File 1103, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the General Register. We will now move on to, this is an informational hearing, this last legislation that we'll be looking at. This is a reviser draft of some language that limits the authority for peace officers to stop or detain drivers in certain circumstances. The language has been worked on by Representative Frazier and Representative Mueller in just the last couple days. And since it's not yet introduced, you know, we weren't able to get it jacketed yet for those purposes. But given that we already had this hearing scheduled on other police accountability bills, we thought it was a good opportunity to have get this language out in front of the public and have folks weigh in. And so with that, I believe Representative Frazier is going to kick us off. Representative Frazier. Yes.
Madam Chair, can you hear me?
Sure can.
All right. Sorry, I got an issue with my video, but I will kick us off. Thank you for hearing this language that we have drafted. I think we're at a critical point right now. We just lost another young Black man before his time. And the reason we're here is because of a traffic stop, that was predicated on expired tabs. From what we know, expired tabs, and then the officer believed they observed an air freshener in his rearview mirror. This story is personal to me. I can remember as a teenager, one day I was driving my aunt's old Ford Escort. Wanted to pick up a friend. We were going to go to a movie and then go out to dinner and hang out and play video games for the rest of the night. I was pulled over. I was in a more affluent neighborhood than my own, driving this vehicle that I guess to the cops didn't seem to belong. They immediately got behind me, pulled me over. When I asked why, they said, well, you have a tail light out. They asked me for my registration, insurance, and license. I showed it to them. The car is in my aunt's name. The insurance was in her name. We did not share the same last name. They didn't believe that it was my vehicle. They pulled me out of the vehicle. They thoroughly searched the vehicle. There was no reason to search the vehicle. Just didn't believe the vehicle was mine. I was detained for about 45 minutes during that stop. I was terrified. I didn't know what to do. This is before cell phones were prevalent. I couldn't call anyone. What I didn't do, I didn't run, I didn't make any sudden moves because I was taught that they fear me more than I fear them. And I don't want to get hurt. I just wanted to make it to where I was going and get back home. Watching a video of Dante, I saw that same fear. I saw myself in that same moment. And I believe he reacted to that fear. He was scared. He just caught his mom before that. He didn't know what to do. And he wanted to get home. And he wasn't far from home. We don't need to have law enforcement making these type of stops. We don't need to create these type of interactions that we're seeing go in a totally wrong direction, that escalate to the point of death on armed Black men. This bill will help address that issue. I am more than happy to work on it with Representative Mueller. I think it speaks exactly, specifically to an issue that we have just seen happen. And it could go a long way in helping to address the accountability issue that we need to have and helping to build more trust in our public safety system. And just hopefully in some way help heal our community. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Vice Chair Mohler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to thank Representative Frazier for working on this bill and sharing his experience with us. And I'm not going to talk more about those experiences, because obviously as a white person, I don't have that same level of knowledge, but we hear so many stories like his. And I thought it might be useful to just let members know a little bit of the background from the United States Supreme Court on this and a little bit of the data, and then talk more about what this bill specifically does. The Supreme Court of the United States has held that law enforcement is permitted to stop a car for any equipment or any moving violation, no matter how great or small, and if the underlying reason is some other hunch about a driver. To be clear, law enforcement who make these pretextual stops are legally permitted to make them. In addition, these types of stops have had a disproportionate and negative impact on communities of color. In Minneapolis, while the city is predominantly white, Black and East African drivers accounted for 78% of police searches that started as stops for moving or equipment violations between 2019 and 2020. In Minneapolis, police found guns or drugs at a marginally higher rate for white drivers compared with Black ones, according to a 2017-2018 analysis by the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office. And looking at equipment stops only, in 2017 to 18, 54% of those were of Black drivers, and about 30% were of white drivers. The disproportionate nature of these stops is consistent across the country. And there's a really great research article that I'd encourage members to read. It's from Stanford from March of 2021. And they said a large and growing body of literature has found suspicious patterns in traffic stop data in communities around the US. The study suggests that police in a significant number of jurisdictions may consider a driver's race either consciously or subconsciously in executing traffic stops. They went on to do a really great analysis in the state of Washington, where there was some Washington case law that said these pretext stops weren't allowed, and then later said they were allowed. And so they could really look at this period of time. And they examined over 8 million traffic stops conducted by the Washington State Patrol between 2008 and 2015. And they found a statistically significant increase in stops and searches of non-white drivers relative to white drivers. They also found that those increase in stops occurred more often during the daytime, when police officers could more easily ascertain a driver's race. And those results support the hypothesis that judicial approval of pretextual stops contributes to an increase in stops that disproportionately impacts people of color. Members, this bill is carefully and narrowly crafted with both public safety and racial disparities in mind. It prohibits stops solely for certain equipment violations and for expired tabs. But I want to tell you what this bill does not do. It does not prohibit stops for moving violations. It does not prohibit stops for impaired driving. It does not prohibit stops if police have reasonable suspicion of a crime. The equipment violations for which a stop is prohibited, something hanging in a rearview mirror, one broken taillight, a tinted windshield, are meant to press pause on a stop and eliminate implicit bias in decision-making. Some conditions of a car could create a safety risk, and those are outlined in the bill, and there's some exceptions here that would allow for a stop. This bill does not eliminate enforcement of these provisions. Parked cars are still subject to citations for these things, as are citations if the car is stopped for other valid reasons. For some, this bill will not go far enough because it doesn't prohibit all pretext stops. And for others, it will go too far because it eliminates some stops. But at the end of the day, this is a carefully crafted bill to decrease racial disparities in police stops while still ensuring public safety. And I'd be glad to answer any questions you have about the bill.
Thank you, Representative Mohler. Do members have any questions about this language in the bill? And in full transparency, I will be offering this language as an amendment tomorrow in the Ways and Means Committee to the Public Safety and Judiciary Omnibus Bill. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just in thinking this bill over a little bit, I'm just wondering what the origins of law enforcement, the law that says law enforcement can pull over someone for expired tabs, if Representative Mueller knows the answer to that question.
Vice Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Representative Scott. I don't know specifically for expired tabs, but expired tabs are listed in Chapter 169 and a number of the different provisions related to equipment and you know, other types of driving offenses are found in that chapter. And so and officers are given broad authority to pull people over for any violation, whether that's a petty misdemeanor, you know, or greater. And so I don't know that there's something specific to tabs as opposed to just, you know, general driving violations or status violations.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I just, to me, that one just sticks out because it's like, to operate a motor vehicle, you should have a driver's license that's valid, and you should have, you know, your car should be properly licensed. To me, those are just two good law-abiding things that every person should have to do to be on the street. But I just had a curiosity more than anything if there was a specific origin behind being able to stop somebody for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scott. And I know in you know, looking at this language with Representative Frazier and Representative Mueller, I mean, I will note that, you know, your license tabs are just proof that you have a properly licensed vehicle. It doesn't actually mean whether, you know, not having the updated number on your cab doesn't mean that you didn't pay for it. It just means that you don't have the sticker on it. And it, you know, interestingly too, I think the tab question, you know, it's not truly equipment in the way that, you know, your signal or your lights or some of those other parts of your vehicle may be, as far as it having anything to do with the operation of the vehicle. So it is kind of an outlier and being sort of, I think, different compared to the other equipment violations that are listed in this language. Any additional member questions? All right. It's been a really long day, but I thank members for your attention. Particularly want to thank Vice Chair Mueller and Representative Frazier, as well as Representative Gomez and Representative Thompson. It was already bound to be an emotionally difficult hearing, even before the killing of Dante Wright this weekend. And I do think it's important, though, that we have these conversations and we have them in public, and that the public has the opportunity to weigh in. So, you know, we will wrap up. Again, we're not voting on this one. It's an informational hearing. We don't have any other regular scheduled meetings, but we will meet at the call of the chair as necessary. And I did think that this particular issue in this moment was a necessary step to take. You know, we will do the same going forward if it's warranted. So we'll just hope that everybody's taking the time to take care of themselves. I know this is a particularly difficult time for the community, and especially our Black community members right now. So there are many of us who are thinking of you, and just hope everybody is able to hold themselves with some grace in this moment, because it is particularly hard. So thank you again, members. Thank you to our testifiers. And with that, we are adjourned.